A listener production.
Hi, and welcome back to Broadsheet Around Town. I'm Publications Director Nick Connellan. Today's guest is a well-known Melbourne food writer who's been in Broadsheet's orbit for more than 10 years now. Last year, she appeared on this very podcast to talk about a transcendent stir fry she ate in Thailand. But we've got her back for a very good reason. Alongside Po Ling Yao and Jean-Christophe Novelli, she's one of three new judges on MasterChef Season 16, which returned to our screens yesterday. Welcome, Sophia Levin.
Good to be back. Thank you, Nick.
Soph, we've known each other for a really long time now, but after last night, I think a lot of people are going to be incredibly curious about who you are and kind of what you've been doing with your life up until this point. So let's go way back. Tell us about growing up in Melbourne and eating and what your relationship with food was.
Huge question. I'll try to be as succinct as I can, but I suppose I've always been surrounded by food. My family always gathered around food. We would do Friday night, Sunday brunch. I'd follow mum along to the market, originally Paran Market and then Victoria Market a little bit later on. But there's always just been this incredible enthusiasm around food in my family, particularly among the women. The boys eat what they're told, they're happy to do whatever and come along for the ride. But I think my mother in particular and her mother in England, it's always been food-focused everything. And mentioning that she's from overseas originally is relevant because what it meant growing up is that we were privileged enough to travel to somewhere that was halfway between London and Melbourne, wherever that was. And often it was Asia because it was more affordable for a family of four and then five with my parents. And just that exposure did wonders. And the enthusiasm with which everything was consumed, whether that was a market visit, a cooking class, a food tour, just going to a restaurant or eating something off the street, that's always been in my orbit, just to steal your words there. And it just continues on. It carries on. As I got older in school, I always loved writing. English was always my best subject. I eventually went into marketing and psychology because I wanted to write ads that really like destroyed people, that made them stop and think. So copywriting was always the plan. And then I realized pretty quickly at uni that marketing and psychology are not very word heavy. It's a lot of, you know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs and things that were just so far from any form of creative writing.
Food's second on that list, right? Maslow's hierarchy? If I cast my mind back to uni days,
that's actually
shelter,
really good.
Food.
Shelter, food. I'd go food, shelter. So I reckon we can rewrite the theory there. But I took second semester of second year off. And you know what it's like in Australia with our timetables. That means you essentially have 9 months off and don't miss anything. So went traveling, and one of the last places my girlfriend and I went on this backpacking adventure was Morocco. And we'd been around Europe and it was amazing. But the contrast of being in a market in Marrakesh and just seeing the aromatic piles of spices and the smoke and the snake charmers. And it was actually like being in Aladdin, one of my favorite Disney movies of all time. And it just left such an impression on me. And the way that everybody was hassling us to eat this and try whatever they had in front of them, that me being me, I decided to work backwards. I was like, right, how can I do this for a job? And use my skill set. And that's when I went back home and switched my major subject to journalism. And then I've just kind of been writing ever since. I started writing about food while I was still in uni, while I was still working at a cafe, and Nick Shelton was hand delivering broadsheet to the cafe I worked at. He used to serve his parents coffee. So yeah, been around the traps for a while, and it's been pretty amazing to be part of the evolution of food in Melbourne, Australia, and in some sense, the world over the last 15 or so years.
Because we've come so far.
Oh, so far. And to sort of have, you know, A-row tickets to that has been incredible. So I feel like I'm just following along and reporting on what's happening rather than taking the lead or anything like that. It's our job to communicate and to tell those stories and to ask the questions. And that's what I love about it.
Mm. So your entry to the media industry, as I understand it, started with one email. Is that right?
Did it?
To someone at Good Food.
Oh, yeah, it did. It did.
I know your story better than you do.
You do know my story better than me. You're right. I was, look, I'd had a couple of pieces published through my journalism tutor on ABC's Environment online page, whatever it was, which was mostly his guidance. But then I was sitting in an internship, a social media internship. I think it was the first social media company with an office in Melbourne. Doesn't exist anymore.
Cutting edge.
It was cutting edge. And it was fun. Like, the people were amazing. We got to be creative. I got to write. We got to knock off early on a Friday and play ping pong and drink beers. And I still didn't love it. I didn't love that sort of office in environment so much. So I sent an email to Roslyn Grundy at Good Food, The Age. Was it Epicure then?
Yeah.
Might have been Epicure then.
Yeah.
People still call it that. And what did I do? I think I just probably pretended to be slightly more professional than I actually was. I did have a body of work because I had a couple of articles that were published in uni. And at the time I had a blog, which essentially served as a portfolio, the same way you do in an arts course or arts degree.
I was the same.
You were the same?
Yeah.
So it's like,
I'm interested. It was the thing of the time, hey?
Well, I got told that I should do one in journalism school, and I did it to suck up to my tutor. but it started off as a really terrible, like, dear diary, not quite that bad, but
for I know all the vibe, aspects, yeah.
Yeah, that. And then it, because of the way my family connected, it became about cafe culture, I guess, and what we ate around town and around town and just in general at home, became very food focused. So I had this body of work. I had a couple of bylines and I had a fair bit of spunk.
So still do.
Still, thank you, I think. and Roz, who I call my Fairfax fairy godmother, or used to when it was Fairfax, she just wrote back. And that's huge for a lot of people entering the industry. And she said, great, you know, your stuff's decent. We're looking for new reviewers for the Good Food Guide. We're doing this, that, the other. And she just gave me a shot. And I guess it did really change the course of where I ended up, because that was my first experience with mainstream media, being a journalism student, or just out of journalism. And it just seemed to go from there. It was amazing.
Yeah. I think what I've always admired about you though, and also Danny Valent, is that you guys don't just cover the same kind of restaurants that everyone else covers. Can you talk a little bit about that mission that you've had over the years and kind of sharpened recently with Seasoned Traveller, your kind of, I guess it's not really a blog. It's kind of more of a fully-fledged publication, but a one-woman publication.
What is the difference between a blog and a website?
Blog's more stream of consciousness, I guess.
Is it? Okay, because I never really know.
It's blurry. It's blurry.
Some people call it a website. Some people call it a blog. I call it a website because it didn't cost what a blog costs to put together. So that's what I do. But, yeah, I think it is spurred by travel and curiosity and my upbringing and definitely my personality. But I have always been interested in trying new things, especially when it comes to eating. And I love context. I've always needed to know the why. And that was before journalism is probably why I ended up here. So it's not just, you know, here's this coffee. It's who made it? What was their story? Why is it so good or why is it not so good? And asking these questions just leads to conversation when you love food and when you're sitting opposite somebody who loves food as well. So that just led me to focus more on places that weren't getting so much media attention, that could be considered the little guys or that maybe existed for their migrant or other communities, to feed these people what made them feel loved and safe and at home. And then in the same breath, while they exist for these little pockets. That doesn't mean they're exclusive to them. It just means you have to go in there yourself if you want to experience it, and then you're welcome with open arms. So they're the experiences that I absolutely adore. And I think off the top of my head now, social media has played a huge role in the ability to communicate places like that quickly. And so I imagine what happened is while I was writing more mainstream food and other stories, in my own time, I was on Instagram or maybe even Facebook at the time, or this blog that doesn't exist anymore, talking about the other stuff. And that was just sort of throwaway. But people started to go to these places or be really interested in them. But the thing that really resonated with me was that other people were saying, you know, I've never tried something like that, or this reminds me of my mom back in whatever country. And it just felt really good. It felt amazing to be able to share that because I love it. And the response that you get from the people who own these businesses is just amazing. It's so warm and just all-encompassing in a way that doesn't always exist when you speak to an incredible chef who is really time poor and maybe is trying to run five restaurants at a time. It's not a great way to make a buck doing journalism, because you sit down for so much longer than you would otherwise chatting to people. But that's what I love. And then it evolved when COVID hit, because my to-do list and all my freelance stories and everything just evaporated completely overnight. So I had time to put this thing together that I'd always spoken about doing and had never done, because I didn't have the time or the resources. But then all of a sudden I had all the time in the world. So it started off with a newsletter just to try and build some sort of an audience rather than just going live with a website. And that was, I'm trying to remember what I called it. I called it the 5 kilometer food tour, the 5 kilometer. It was catchier than that.
I subscribed, I should know, but I can't remember.
Well, I should know because I created and wrote it. 5 kilometer world food tour. Anyway, the concept behind it was that within our 5 kilometer radius, there was a whole world of food to explore. And then I just researched the hell out of the northern, eastern, southern, western suburbs, and found places that were serving different cuisines and talked about what they were actually doing for lockdowns and COVID. So it just gave people something to do. It gave me something to do. And that built up an audience. So then when I actually spent the rest of the time writing 100 plus articles for Season Traveler over that period, it was alive. You know, there was something to actually look at.
And sink your teeth into.
Yeah, exactly.
You're obviously so passionate about this. This is what's driven you for the past 10, 15 years. And MasterChef's not going to put a stop to that. How do you plan to use the MasterChef, this new platform that you have, to kind of keep doing that and bring even more attention to those underserved stories?
Yeah, it's actually incredible to think about how it's converged in this way, because a competition like MasterChef, it's got such a huge mainstream audience. And I've had the privilege of speaking to people who are already kind of interested in what we talk about. You know, they sign up to Broadsheet, they sign up to Season Traveler, they follow us on Instagram. And so you're preaching to the converted in a way. But with something like MasterChef, it's just so broad and far reaching that the thing that is most exciting is to be able to include so many new people on this journey. And that's not just through my personal website, that's through the contestants as well, who have always been incredibly diverse, just because Australia
is diverse.
Is diverse, exactly. So, I mean, we've now obviously finished filming, but on the show, I think that exists in just the way I hope I have encouraged the contestants to lean into what they know. So that doesn't necessarily mean having to sit still. So if you have Southeast Asian background or whatever it might be, yes, you've got dishes and memories around them, but there's nobody saying that you have to cook the most traditional version of that. Absolutely give us the traditional version, because it's almost always delicious. But seeing them grow over the season and, you know, sort of appropriate techniques from top chefs who set pressure tests and work that into a Sri Lankan dish or whatever it might be, that's the thing that I found most amazing during filming. And that's the thing I'm most excited to see people latch onto when they watch MasterChef Australia as well.
Tell us about some of those contestants and the relationships that you form with them. Do you guys fraternize when you're not filming?
Well, do you know what? It's, we don't really. We chat on set, but the day is so full. So much time is taken up by the actual cook and the deliberations and the judging that you don't go and have a coffee or a glass of wine. You don't do that. It would be a bit wrong, I think, anyway. But you do chat on set, and then probably the thing that you wouldn't see during the filming is that if you feel like you have extra advice or extra tips or whatever it might be, while they're resetting, you'll run down to one of the benches and just have a quick like 2 to 3 minute chat and be like, these are the other things that you should think about for next time. Or this is what I really liked, because obviously there are so many people to get through, especially at the start. There's only a day and it's a long day. But there's always so much to talk about and so much to say. So if that's fraternizing, then yes, we do.
But yeah, tell me about some of the contestants and the personalities that we can kind of look forward to. Obviously it's hard because we don't want to give anything
away.
Yeah,
no, but I absolutely can. It's the contestants are all really different, whether it's cultural background or age or their skill set and style. But it's amazing to see people from major cities in Australia, but also the far reaches of the country as well. And then we've got people who are born overseas or who have family overseas. So you'll see Sri Lankan, you'll see Indian, you'll see South American, you'll see Thai. And it's been amazing because I've been lucky enough to travel to some of these countries, but they're still plating up their version of dishes or regional dishes where I'm like, that's familiar, but it's different to me. So I still get to learn pretty much every day.
And for me, that's on a personal level is what's making Australian food really exciting now is those emerging regional cuisines, like the booming Thai scene in Melbourne that's finally caught up to Sydney, or the kind of emerging regional Indian cuisines. That's what's really interesting and exciting at the moment.
And the other thing that I think makes Australian food in general so exciting is our produce, right? So people who don't necessarily, people who just consider themselves full-blown Aussie, whatever that means to them, they've got an incredible handle and understanding of meat and butchery or fish and seafood in general. So viewers will learn pretty quickly who specializes in what, but it's when they break away from what they know that they really shine.
I'm always amazed at how accomplished these chefs are. Like, I consider myself a pretty decent home cook. Like, I cook a lot of curries from scratch and kind of breads and pastries and stuff and, you know, hand-pulled noodles. But then I see these people where they're told by some top chef, you have to cook this insane pastry that's got 6 layers and you're not getting a recipe. Here's the ingredients. Figure it out. And they do it. They're amazing.
Well, the first thing I'll say to that is maybe you should consider applying for MasterChef season 17 because we're about to start casting again.
I'm not good under pressure in the kitchen. It's like if someone talks to me, I'm like, quiet.
There's a lot of pressure and there's a lot of talking to you.
Yeah,
so maybe not for you. But yeah, MasterChef gets thousands of applications and they are filtered through by expert producers, people who understand the show really deeply, who try the dishes that these people put up, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dishes. They go on a tour of the country. So it's not a coincidence that they're all very good, right? But they are all home cooks. So none of them have had kitchen experience. You're not actually allowed to be a contestant if you've got a certificate of cookery. You have too much of an advantage. So to see the base level that they come into the kitchen with is unbelievable. It's just incredible. And then adding to that, working under pressure, under a time pressure of usually 75 minutes, but not just cooking for 75 minutes, coming up with the dish based on some sort of boundaries set by the challenge and running and getting all the equipment and getting all the ingredients from the pantry. I couldn't do it. In fact, I've been asked to do it and I said no.
Yeah, which is probably just as well. Improvisation factor, right? Like following a recipe is one thing, but The improvisation.
God. Yeah. It's and they get really good at it really, really, really fast. And then you've got pressure tests where they like these recipes, they're tried and tested and they work and they absolutely have to, but they're 100 plus steps long and they're using equipment and technique and skills that people use in fine dining restaurants because they're often set by fine dining chefs. And it's amazing to see what people can achieve when they push themselves in any industry. But when you can measure it by how something turns out and tastes, that's pretty special.
But also on camera.
Like on
if
camera.
It wasn't stressful enough, you're on camera as well. It's
yeah,
crazy.
We all forget about the cameras eventually, even as I'm talking, but you do. You've got people interviewing you on the spot because, you know, yes, it's a cooking competition, but it's also televised. So you need to participate.
Speaking of cameras, the thing I've kept thinking about over the past few weeks, we're recording this podcast and you have, let's say, a moderate level of fame. You've got like 30,000 followers on Instagram, but within a few months, you're going to be at that level, right, where walking down the street, people are going to want selfies. They might interrupt your dinner. How are you thinking about that and dealing with that?
I am thinking about that. It's interesting because I've had just a little taste of it already prior to anything MasterChef-y, just because people who are passionate about food know the people who work in the very small food media industry. So
yeah, and you've been on TV before. You did the cook-up and postcards. And
Do you know what the most recognized I've been has actually been since taking Mark Wiens around from Migrationology because he's so famous that people actually have recognized me as being the person who showed him around Melbourne,
right.
Which, and in, you know, in restaurants in the outer suburbs, it's amazing, but it has been people who are passionate about their culture who want to come up and make a recommendation or talk or take a picture. So I understand it a little bit, but the level that it's about to become is scary.
I was going to say scary. Scary is the word.
But look, it's fine, and the food industry is largely positive. I'm sure I'll cop a bit of slack just being a woman in the media, as many women in the media often do. But that's
slack
fine.
Slack or flack?
Flack. No slack. No slack. Cop flack. A bit of flack. Thank you. But it's fine. It's exciting. It's part of the package, really. I was sort of looking a bit to Jamie Oliver without realizing how to deal with it. And when we went out for dinner when he was around, his lovely assistant was very good when people came over and wanted a photo with him, of saying, he'll come around after, like, we're just going to enjoy our meal now. And then he'll be with you afterwards. And I'm like, I'm never going to be as famous as Jamie Oliver, but I'm absolutely going to pinch.
So he's
going to
do
line.
The rounds at the restaurant and stop at every
does,
table afterwards.
But he loves it, and people love him, and it's completely genuine. So he'll go into a kitchen when he hasn't necessarily been asked, knowing that people are probably trying to give him space to enjoy himself. It's one of the ways in which he gives back, I think. So he'll just walk in, be like, do you guys want to take a picture? No. Do you want to have a chat? Yes, whatever. He'll leave it to them, but he'll do it in a way so that nobody has to ask. And I just think that's so classy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice approach. So what's next? Season one's in the bag. And you told me before off mic that you've started writing again, but what else is on the cards?
I'm excited to see what happens and what unfolds. I absolutely want to keep talking about these little places and, you know, experiencing new food and different cultures myself. That's never going to change. So I think it's just the audience that I speak to who want to come along for that journey. That's going to grow. So that's really exciting. I'm plotting a trip a couple of weeks away in South Korea, hopefully.
You're always away.
Well, I'm glad you think that because I feel like I haven't been away for ages, but South Korea has been on the cards since the cancelled COVID trip, which everyone had some version of. But somebody once said to me, I can't remember who it is, maybe someone will listen to this and tell me, but it's stuck in my head ever since, that Seoul was like Tokyo with the volume turned up, and I've never been able to get it out of my head. So I want to go eating for a couple of weeks or a few weeks sometime there, and then there'll be a bunch of stories that come out of that. But it's really hard to tell what life is going to be like post MasterChef Australia airing. But I like to think that I'll remain the same, and the things that I'm interested in and the conversations that I have will also remain the same. It'll just be on a much larger scale, which is so great.
Love that. Thank you so much for coming on. It's been awesome having you, as
Thank
always.
Thank you. Love being here. Thanks, Nate.
That's it for today. If you're enjoying the podcast, tell your friends and family, leave us a review, and keep listening. Subscribe or follow us wherever you're listening now to make sure that you don't miss an episode.